Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Joining us today is Dr. Marcel Tuckman, a board-certified internist who serves as professor of clinical medicine at New York University's School of Medicine, one of the best in the world. Tuckman is a Holocaust survivor who was born in Poland and earned his medical degree at Heidelberg University in Germany. Marcel Tuckman is the author of Remember, My Stories of Survival and Beyond, which is published by the Holocaust Survivors Memoir Project at Yad Vashem. Dr. Marcel Tuckman, thank you so much for being with us. Appreciate your being here.
Well, Professor Chartok, I am deeply grateful for the opportunity to speak to you about the book because I believe strongly that we, as the survivors, and not many of us are left, have the solemn duty to remember the heinous crime that was committed and afflicted our people and left an indelible stain on the civilization that allowed it to happen.
Let me start by asking you this. How old are you?
I was born in 1921.
Wow. Well, it is quite a story. And the book, of course, if you're Jewish or if you're not Jewish, I have to tell you, I kept having to wipe the tears away from my eyes. It's quite something. So take us from the beginning. Where were you born?
I was born in Poland, in eastern Poland, in a town by the name of Przemyśl, which is hard to pronounced with P-R-Z-E-M-Y-L, and I lived there only for about 8-9 years, and then we moved to Krakow and Warsaw, and that's where the war, that's where I met the war, and escaping the original invasion, going east, I landed again in the place where I was born, and that's where I stayed until the war between the Germans and the Russians started, and then the occupation of the Germans, by the Germans, of this town and, of course, of the entire region. And shortly after the occupation started, the Przemyśl, as well as the surroundings, became a region designated as a ghetto. And the ghetto was really a step towards ultimate extermination in the nearby concentration camps of destructions, of the extermination in Belzec and Szczebnie and ultimately in Auschwitz and Treblinka, which is now well familiar. We had as the head of the ghetto a sadistic Austrian commanding officer who ultimately was the target of the last trial in Stuttgart, where I was a witness. His name was Schwamberger. He escaped detection for many, many decades and ultimately was captured thanks to the Wiesenthal sleuth and arrested. And by then he was 90 years old and ultimately, convicted and sentenced to life in prison and died within less than a year. But the trial was an important one because it exposed his crimes and exposed the whole question of how the Jews in Eastern Europe were exterminated. Now, I spent time in the ghetto until its liquidation in 1943 in September, which I describe in my book, which was a very, very, it's hard to describe with a word other than and a horror, exterminated. There were 1,600 Jews, among them my mother, were murdered on the site, stripped naked and digging their own graves and perished. The rest of us were evacuated to first Shebni, which was a transit camp, but also a camp without gas, but with carbines and pistols and other means of torture, and ultimately wound up in Birkenau, Auschwitz, in October of 1943. And there, I'm sure it's well known that this was kind of a place where, which was a antichambre to gas. And while some members of my family were sent to gas on that selection, my father and I, remarkably, were passed into the camp. And the camp became a kind of a slave market. They would select groups of people for various works for the Germans, some mass selections of people for the Eastern Front to dig ditches and to do the and be the fodder for the Russian guns. And smaller groups were selected thanks to their skills that the Germans needed, because that was the period when the German territory was being heavily bombed by the Allied forces. So they needed professionals in technical skills to take over for the Germans, who were then selected for the army on the Eastern Front. Fortunately, they requested one small group of technical tools and dice makers. Now, neither my father or I were tool and die makers. However, again, luck played a tremendously important role.
Luck in your father's guts.
Yeah, luck that on my father's side, and courage on my father's side. Mm-hmm. But the man who was interviewing us was a Siemens engineer.
Now, Siemens is a corporation, major corporation.
Siemens, yes. The intent was to select a group of some 80 to 100 technical skillful workers and to build a factory to which we later learned was for switches for the bombs, the automatic bombs that were sent on London. And the Mr. Bunces, Karl Bunces, who was the selecting officer, in a rather small office in the presence of the SS Sturmführer and the Block Älteste, who was the prisoner but with privileges, my father was being interviewed. And a remarkable, rather mysterious kind of a relationship developed. My father was an educated person. He completed his studies in Vienna, spoke German very well. This was after World War One. And there was some kind of a sympathetic relationship. As I mentioned, my book, unheard of in Auschwitz, for a German to address a prisoner as Z, which is a kind of an honorific. And he said, Herr Tuchmann. And he was obviously very sympathetic. What he needed was someone who spoke German well and who was educated and had a calligraphic handwriting of all things, which my father fulfilled all these requirements. And Mr. Bunces said, you are accepted. And at this point, something unheard of happened. My father said in German, Ich habe eine Bedingung, which means I have a condition. Well, this is an act of courage that ultimately saved our lives, that for which, you know, not only have I admired my father, but I owed him my survival. So the reaction was kind of a bedingung. He says, yes, I have a son without whom I would not go. He says, where is your son? He says, he's standing outside with a group of people waiting for interviews. He says, let him come in. It was obvious that my interview was a sham. He showed me a drawing which any person with elementary school education would recognize. I said, this is a screw. He says, yes, but where is the bolt? I said, I don't see it. He says, well, you are right, because I have a separate drawing. You are also accepted. Well, this was the pivotal moment of our survival.
Sure.
Because once we were selected by Siemens, all of the 80 or 90 people were exempt from weekly selections to gas. And we were sequestered into a separate block and so on. Not that the life was any different, but the survival was different. And we built that factory until from November of 1943 till May, when we moved out of Birkenau into the factory, where we stayed until the Russian moving westwards rapidly threatened to enter the Auschwitz area. We went on a series of death marches.
I'm going to stop you right there because I don't want to cross too quickly from your experiences early in the camp. You mentioned that the commandant was a notorious sadistic monster. Can you tell us something about what life was like in the camps then?
Well, my stay in the ghetto was divided actually in part for a slave labor camp. It was an army slave labor camp, which was outside of the ghetto, where we were working with the in storage of military equipment and in being involved with the unloading of the soldiers from the Eastern Front, actually carrying on our backs the injured ones who came frozen. And that was a part where I describe a contact with a Austrian physician, Franz Josef Darte, who empathized with our fate and actually invited us into sequestered quarters to tell us that if we want to survive, we have to join the partisans. And he provided us with, or at least wanted to provide us with weapons, with a revolver. We were unfortunately stopped after that day, after having gotten only ammunition, never gotten a revolver, because there was a catastrophe which I describe, where a Gestapo officer in the ghetto was attacked by a Jewish boy, stabbed, and 100 hostages were taken, and our getting out of the ghetto has ended. So we could never get the revolver, perhaps likely, because the partisans were not very helpful to the Jewish refugees.
Why were the partisans not helpful to the refugees?
Well, there were two groups of underground. There was the People's Army and there was a National Army. The National Army was not only not helpful, but very often would expose the escapees to the Gestapo.
Is that because the Poles had at the time, and still do to some degree, a reputation for anti-Semitism?
The reputation for anti-Semitism extended into the time when the Poles were equally victims of the occupiers.
Interesting.
Which was an irony. I cite there an incident when after typhus I was recovering from coma. Next to me was a Polish Gentile who was a prisoner. The first thing I remember is he accused me of deicide for the Christ crucifixion. So you can see that anti-Semitism was so deeply rooted in Poland, and still is, unfortunately, that it that the camaraderie that should have extended into the concentration camp did not materialize.
So there's a story in the book, of course, about the gold coins. You want to tell us about that?
Yeah, well, that was, since we were in the ghetto, my parents were in the ghetto, and I was in that army camp. The ghetto was deprived of any essentials, food, as well as candles and soap and so on. So we tried to organize. The term organize was used, you know, with all kinds of legal or illegal ways obtaining those products and smuggle them into the ghetto to our parents or our friends. And on one occasion when I was leaving the ghetto after having provided my parents with those things, crossing the wall of the ghetto, I was surrounded by youngsters screaming, "Jews, Jews, Jews," promptly arrested and sequestered into a prison cell. And that meant that at the end of the week, I would be sent to, as all those who were arrested would be sent to for execution. That was the order of the camp commander. Well, while there, and I needed to preface by saying that the only treasure we had was a gold coin. It was a $20 gold coin, which my mother sewed into a little kind of a sack that I wore around my neck in the hope that maybe on one occasion it might save my life. Well, when I was arrested, we were searched, and they found on me a letter that I was carrying from the ghetto to a son who was working in this camp, in which the parents said, through the radio, we found out that the Turks are trying to buy out Jews to save them from concentration camps. So they caught that as a reason to suspect that I knew something about underground radio, which was actually tantamount to death sentence. I said I didn't know what the letter contained. I know nothing of this. Anyway, as luck had it, I was confronting a functionary of the railroad police who was sympathetic. So as I was being searched, he touched my, he of course uncovered that I had this little sack, he touched it and whispered close to me, because there were others in that room. He says, "Gold?" I said, "Yes." "Coin?" I said, "Yes." And he sent me back to the cell. And then after I had served as a translator for an employee who was being interviewed for a job, a Polish employee, they called me back. He made a call, which I believe to this day was a sham call to the Gestapo, and he described the circumstances of my arrest. But he said that I was carrying my Jewish identification. I was not trying to do to escape. What should he do? So came to me back and he said, "Well, you will be paying fine in German marks," which were also in that little sack, which meant really nothing. And he came close and I thought, well, now the coin will be here. He came very close to me and whispered, "And the brown pieces of tin you can keep," and he let me go.
What do you make of that? It was a remarkable part of the book. Right. By the way, let me just tell everybody that we are talking to Dr. Marcel Tuckman. Remember, My Stories of Survival and Beyond. So what did you make of that? Was this a good man?
Well, I do really attribute human heart in this man who was a policeman and who was part of the occupation forces, because as we met him on the road a few days later, he saw me marching with a group. He waved to me and smiled, and I waved back. This was a word-free exchange of human emotions. I did give him credit for humanitarian motives.
Let me pursue the gold coin, because it didn't end up so well. One of the most horrific stories in the book had to do with how you had to eventually surrender that gold coin.
What happened was, when I was in Shebnya, there was a roll call. We didn't know what that roll call was about. Ultimately, it was deportation to Auschwitz. So we had this gold coin hidden in a loaf of bread, and we left that loaf of bread in an oven, which is a kind of a primitive a stove, and we never returned to our barrack, and ultimately we left it there for any Pole who was very, successful in finding it, but we never regretted it, because it really was worth surviving.
So the gold coin was in the bread, but there was another point at which you had some coins. You were standing next to a man who also had some contraband. Can you tell us that story?
Well, the story is, when we were being searched upon entering Shebnya, that was the camp, I had a pair of boots, of army boots, on me. And in the seam of those boots, I had about 3 or 4 of small gold coins. These were Russian Tsar's gold coins.
Where'd you get them?
Well, when we were escaping, we took all valuables with us, and these were the remnants of it. And when I was in line, my father had already passed, and I handed him the bread with the gold coin. And he left, so he was not searched, and the gold coins at that point was salvaged. However, when I saw the man, the tailor, who refused to render, to give up.
He was right next to you. And
yeah, he was
and he
in front of me,
yes.
And he was warned that if he doesn't give up all that he has hidden, he will be shot. And indeed, he refused to. And then they found either gold coins or some foreign currency. And the man who was sitting there and was searching us said, "You will be shot." And he turned him around, pointed his pistol at his neck. The pistol misfired first. He reloaded it and shot him, and the man fell virtually in front of me.
And you were
when
next.
When I saw that, mm-hmm. I took my boots and I threw them into the big basket that I mentioned looked like the treasure that pirates used to put valuables in. So when I came to him and he asked me, "Is there anything you have?" I said, "Nothing," and it was correct. But we saved that gold coin through transmitting it to my father. But ultimately, when a few days later, when there was the roll call, we hid it in the oven, and we never returned to that barrack. So the gold coin remains only in our memory.
So there were horrific things that went on to you. You were beaten. Your father was beaten. You had people punching you with gun butts, things like that. Does all of that remain vivid in your mind?
Well, of course. It's interesting that all these horrors, when I read my book back, almost sound impossible to have survived.
Yes.
And yet, we all kind of accepted this. We accommodated. We resigned ourselves to that, so that even death, not only beating, but death would not have been a surprise.
What do you attribute, Marcel Tuckman, Dr. Tuckman, what do you attribute your getting through when so many people didn't?
Well, I cannot speak for everybody. Obviously, the individuals are individual. In my case, the presence of my father, who was also a prisoner, and he was an older prisoner, so more vulnerable, but his presence, in my perception, was my protection. So I said, nothing will ever happen to me that he would not make an effort to save me from. And I had a very happy and secure childhood. And I think that that undoubtedly had an important influence on my optimistic view. The other thing that was very important, which was a self-deception, we felt that the world knows about what we are going through and is up in arms to save us. Little did we know, and I actually use that phrase, is that if we knew that the world knows, but it's very, very silent about it, we would have gone on the electrified, as some did, wires surrounding the camp and ended our life.
They literally committed suicide by running to the electric fence.
Right. But I never had doubts that with protection of my father and perhaps some naive feeling that maybe I'm anointed with some luck, that I will survive. And one day, in fact, when I was a witness at the first Bergen-Belsen trial, the president of the court said, you must have been very important because you know so much about the topography of the camp. I said, no, General. I said, I was just anyone, not important at all, but I was hoping, and that probably sustained me, that one day I'll be facing my liberators and be able to tell about the horrors that our nation had gone through.
Some people came out of those camps profoundly unreligious, thought if anything like this could be done to the Jewish people, for example, there couldn't be a God. What about you?
Well, I was raised in a secular environment. My parents were, and my grandparents were traditional, but there was no emphasis on religion as such. It never occurred to me that God would be preoccupied with us having the world to take care of. So it really never, but I know exactly what you are saying, and many people felt that if there were God, God would not have allowed it to happen. Well, that is not my belief, no. I don't think that God interferes in the human affairs as some of the deeply religious Jews and Gentiles really believe. I think it was, we are forging our own life. Life is a gift, and what we make of it is us. I don't think that we rely on some supernatural force that will take care of us. So religion never entered into it, but I know that it did in many instances.
Do you remember the day in that hotel when you knew you were free? Do you remember the moment, the day?
Absolutely.
Was it May 2nd?
Unforgettable moment. This was after a death march that cost 5,000 people, documented in Sachsenhausen. We survived, and we were, on May 2nd, we were marching towards the town where we were liberated in northern Germany, Schwerin-Mecklenburg. and a tank with a German officer through the turret was facing us. And at this point, he pointed his thumbs down. This was a moment that we waited for 4 years.
He was telling you that they had lost.
Yes, that Germany was lost. So finally, when we reached the hotel, totally exhausted, near death, we fell asleep, to be awakened a few hours later by American soldiers, still covered by camouflage dust and so on. He says, "You are free." Well, no symphony of Mozart, Beethoven, no bells of the heavens sounded better than those few words.
When did your father pass?
My father died in 1959. He survived with me, and he lived actually partly in Germany, partly in America, because he was very independent. He didn't want to rely on charitable institutions. So he attempted to create a business. And since his expertise was business and language, he could not very well adapt to America, where he was not as fluent as he required it for his standards. So part of the time he lived in Germany and opened a business, both to support himself and to help me through my studies.
So he wanted a doctor for a son, yes?
Yeah.
And he encouraged...
That goes back to my teenage, he says. He wanted and I wanted.
I mean, you came into this camp, you got done, you were on death march, you wake up one day, you're free. How do you get to a medical school?
Well, that was an interesting thing. The United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation and the military government, in coordination, opened the first university in Germany after the liberation, or after the end of war, 13 years after Judenfrei, after no Jews at academia. And as soon as my father heard it on the radio that Heidelberg is opening, he says, "You take the train, go down." And indeed, I did. And I came to the American, I think he was a major, yes, I have this in the book. He interviewed me and three of my colleagues who were also survivors. We came and we presented ourselves and being interviewed, and we were taken as the first three Jewish students after 13 years. And this was in September. In October, classes started. And I ultimately, 3 years later, 4 years later, in 1949, graduated with MD degree cum laude. In a new language, in a new culture, sitting at the benches with my former tormentors. That was the spirit that not only I claim credit for, but my colleagues, to whom I pay great tribute for their spirit, their culture, and their values. Mm-hmm. They said that this is the way to restore our nation to what is the traditional nation of the book.
We're talking to Marcel Tuchman. He's an MD and professor at NYU. The name of the book is Remember, My Stories of Survival and Beyond. And I guess I want to ask you a little bit about the way in which anti-Semitism was still around in Heidelberg at the time. You tell a very interesting story about two students who were sitting in the classroom with you. Can you tell us that one?
Yeah, well, this was, you see, I'm sure that you remember that I became very friendly with a member of the American CIC, Mr. Penham, who was professor, ultimately, of French literature at Columbia.
And one of your great heroes.
Beg your pardon?
One of your great heroes, personal heroes.
Yes, very great heroes, because he became committed to weeding out all those who embraced the Nazi philosophy and anti-Semitism, that he wanted to weed out from the faculty. Unfortunately, at that time, there was a kind of a change in politics. The Ruskies became our suspected enemies, and the Germans became fraternized with us. And he actually was deeply depressed by this turn of events.
So he was in charge of sort of denazification there.
Yeah, he was in charge of denazification, and he did not succeed in the way he wanted to do it. And actually, in Potsdam, at the post-war conference, there was the conclusion that all those should not be included in faculties to poison the new generations of German. But nevertheless, he didn't succeed. He was not given the support of the American government. And he ultimately became very depressed, as I describe in my encounter with him.
But there were these two young men sitting in the front of the room.
Yeah, the two young men were poo-pooing. They were the first Holocaust deniers, because at that time they showed films depicting the horrors of Bergen-Belsen with masses of cadavers. And they said, this is all propaganda. Never happened. And I waited till the end of the class, and I made what today sounds a little bit funny, a citizen's arrest. Two big 6-foot, still wearing parts of uniforms, the Man. Boots and the breeches. And they walked with me to Penham about a mile, following me like little puppies. And when I came to Penham, and I told he and his cohort, Mr. Wolf, I told him the story. Well, he was temperamental. He could hardly hold himself from killing them. So I didn't describe it in detail, but he really beat the hell out of them.
Really?
And then, it's interesting, they sat on benches next to me, not exactly next to me, but in the same classroom, for the next 4 years. Never did I see any signs of either hostility, or they were totally like lambs, you know. It's interesting. This is an interesting description of German mentality. There was such passivity when they were under, is so contrasting with the activity and malevolent activity when they were on top. So this was one of those examples.
I want to follow up on that, Dr. Tuckman. And in your book, you talk about the concept of retribution. I mean, some of these people who were guarding you were terrible, terrible, sadistic monsters. And you said that there were people in there who swore eternal vigilance. If they ever got out, they would beat the hell out of these people. They would find them. They would murder them. They would do whatever they had to do. But that didn't happen. How come?
Well, I must quote my wife, who said, whose sister didn't give up her child and went to gas with her child. When she saw that, she said, when I am liberated, if I am liberated, I will do the same to all German children. Once we were liberated, and I quote her directly, she says, if I did that, I would be no better than what they were.
On the other hand, there is one story in the book that I enjoyed, in which you found one of your former tormentors, and you turned him in. You want to tell us about that?
Not only turning him, I broke his arm. We beat the hell out of him, and I had this was a visceral reaction.
Who was the guy?
This was the guard who was guarding us in the Siemens factory in Berlin. He was a psychotic sadist. He was a small punk in the SS uniform who, seeing these people, us, virtually on the verge of death, we were standing on our legs barely. And we had diarrhea and all kinds of diseases of malnutrition, and we would run to the latrine, and he would hold us until we were unable to hold anything and beat us with carbine on our aching bellies. Now, when we caught him, my friend Henry Schwarzbaum and I...
we want to hear this. How did you find him?
Well, this was very shortly after the liberation. We were moved to Lüneburg, and many SS people shed their uniforms and hid as civilians. And this was accidental. We were walking on the street, and here he was. And this scene, you know, if anybody would put together a documentary, this would be a wonderful scene where we caught him. This is... "You don't know us, but we know you, Jakob Flick. We happen to know." And we kind of described to him why he is being... He, of course, was like a rat caught in a trap.
And you saw him as a sort of pathetic creature at that point. Without his Nazi uniform, he looked like a very small little man.
Not only small little man, but he was a puny punk. And then, you know, he received... Now,
you and your friend beat him up.
Yeah, and when I actually... It was very interesting because this was in the POW camp, British. Then we moved to the British zone, and the British soldier who met us with him, and I told him what this man was. He said, "I'm leaving you alone with him," you know, almost giving us the free hand. Anyway, after we did with him what we needed viscerally to do with him, we sent him back to the prison. What I want to stress here, the reason I was so satisfied viscerally with this is because these people who did as much terrible torture as even the big wheels never got what they deserved, because the courts were so overloaded that they let them go. So that was kind of a momentary satisfaction to do, especially seeing my father bending over from pain and this man sadistically treating him. I had the desire to let this man know what a sadist, what a terrible, not human being, what an animal he is.
We've heard every once in a while from people who describe what is called survivor's guilt. Survivor's guilt meaning they got out and 6 million Jews didn't. Have you ever experienced any of that?
Well, I didn't experience it, but I have actually in my wife's family, one of her brothers, who ultimately became a diplomatic member of the Israeli diplomatic corps, survived because he was outside of Germany. He expressed the extreme guilt, you may say, but extreme sorrow that the whole family was exterminated. How come that he survived? You know, this is not a phenomenon that is rare, but, you know, totally unjustified, because this was a fate. This was not by intent.
But there were some who, in order to survive, would do anything.
That is a different thing, yes. That is something that, you know, my mother was a victim of. My mother was hidden in a bunker when there was the liquidation of the ghetto. And a man, a Jewish man, who was trying to save his life, denounced that bunker, which ultimately with 30 people was uncovered and ultimately murdered. There were people, but on the other hand, when there was this, I described that when I was watching with others the execution of some 500 people, the Germans approached every group of people that was moving with an offer to survive if they would disclose the location of hidden Jews. And out of those 500 people, there may have been two or three who bought that offer. The rest people went courageously, heroically to their immediate death. So it was not a universal thing. There was a lot of heroism on the part of people, mothers with children. The other thing that was not uncommon in the ghetto were young people who had the chance of surviving would inject morphine, a deadly dose of morphine, to their parents or grandparents to prevent them from going through the humiliating and torture. And that was the euthanasia of courage.
You, of course, started out in Poland, but there have been many people who have written about the Jewish-German psyche, that many German Jews felt themselves more German than Jewish. Do you have any insights into that?
That was true, yes. That was true. Actually, even after the Holocaust, there was still this kind of a hierarchy. The Polish Jews were the trash. The German Jews were the aristocracy. Feudal system among Jews.
And did that carry over to the United States, do you think?
Well, I don't know. I don't think so. I think people are a little bit smarter now. But that was, I remember when Hitler expelled Jews who were not indigent German citizens to Poland. And those refugees, Jewish refugees, came to Poland. They were, you know, they were treated as less of a quality citizens than the German Jews who were true indigent German citizens.
Dr. Tuckman, you ended up having a rather interesting reunion in the White House. You want to tell us about that?
Yes. That was not in the White House. That was with the president. Our older son, Jeffrey Tuckman, is a cinematographer, is a filmmaker, a documentary filmmaker. And he worked and he actually directed and filmed President Clinton during his campaign and created the film Men from Hope. And during that time, he became very friendly with the White House. And they organized a 50-year reunion, of which the president and his wife were guests, and the filmmakers who...
Now, the reunion was of?
It was invited guests to celebrate, including a group of 10 people, of whom my wife and I were included, who had been singled out because of our survivorship. You see, it was not because of any distinction. Elie Wiesel was there and other people, some heroic members of the Battle of Britain. It was kind of a end of war
50
reunion.
Years later.
Yes.
And what was that like?
Well, it was, first of all, it was, they recreated an atmosphere of 1945. With the orchestra of
Glenn Miller.
Yes.
Glenn Miller, yes.
Glenn Miller was, and the food was served the way it was there, and the president and his wife were there as guests. And it was, I had a very interesting encounter with Mr. Clinton. I said to him that I never had the opportunity to thank an American president.
Looking back on Franklin Roosevelt, as long as you mention that, what do you make of his role in the Holocaust?
Well, that's an ambiguous thing, you know. Probably the best way I can say is to in his favor. that when Jan Karski, the famous courier, told him what was going on in Warsaw Ghetto, and he listened for 2 hours, and his only reaction was, "We shall win the war." But that is what, and what I credit him with is that he would not accept his advisors to negotiate with Hitler, but he insisted on unconditional surrender, which I think was a wonderful thing. However, what I think when I say that the world was silent, this was true for America, this was true for Britain, this was true for neutral countries, that they did not, either they disbelieved what they knew was happening, or they said, that's not my turf. Many people could have been saved. And I mentioned the book by Wyman, David Wyman, professor at the University of Massachusetts, a remarkably documented book about the abandonment of the Jews. And he documents the total, almost cynical disregard for opportunities to save Jews. Not all of the Jews, but some of the Jews. And every life was precious.
Marcel Tuchman, tell me, if you will, about Yad Vashem and how you came, we only have a few minutes left, but how you came to write this book.
Well, you know, when you have something like that inside you, it has to come out. I actually didn't intend to until about year 2002, and I went through some minor operation, and while in the hospital, I was talking to one of my friends, visitors, and I told him some of the stories which occasionally I did tell, and he says, you must write about it. So this was kind of a catalyst. He was a catalyst to this book. But once I started writing, it really was a compulsion. And thanks to my friend here, who is here so silently, Mrs. Wright, she facilitates both the mechanics, the technique of writing it, because I'm not a very disciplined writer, and she helped me a great deal. So as I kept writing, I first wrote the first part, and when I showed it to some of my friends and my sons, what happened after? This is not enough. We want to know more. So I added the beyond, and I'm so glad that I did, because it really is a great tribute to this, to the ability to overcome what was the suffering, the humiliation, the degradation, that we need, number one, we need to, and we have a sacred duty to pay tribute to honor the memory of those whose voices were silenced in the concentration camps, in gas and in crematories. That must be spoken for. And also, the intent was to disseminate the information, to add to the big Holocaust literature so that the world learns from it and remains vigilant when violation of the basic fundamental tenets and canons of civilization are being violated, that one should take action, not wait until the catastrophe happens.
This leads to a fast question. My wife put out a book which is now and has gone through several printings, and it's called Can It Happen Again? Can it?
Well, I don't have a crystal ball. I only...
Well, just judging man's capacity for inhumanity to man or woman.
I say in one of my chapters, the great disappointment was that after what the world learned, that there still happens that people are killing each other, people are bigoted, people are totally insensitive to the suffering of many people. their neighbors and their families and so on. That raises the question, will humans become humans? And I don't mean this in semantic way. I mean it in the deeply moral, ethical way. Something must happen that what we hear on the radio and television every day is happening in all corners of the world should never happen again. Can it happen? Yes, it can. The reason I say that, because the Holocaust was anticipated. If people read Mein Kampf, if people went through Kristallnacht, if people learned the Nuremberg laws, it had to ultimately end up with a final solution. It took only the cynical group of technocrats to create the plan and a mode of destroying or doing a genocide. Can it happen again? I only hope it will never happen again. Yes. I don't think we should abandon our vigilance, and I don't think that we should tolerate either verbal antisemitism or violent antisemitism, because that is a preamble to a potential catastrophe.
Our guest has been Dr. Marcel Tuckman. Remember My Stories of Survival and Beyond. Yad Vashem helped in the publication of this book. And Dr. Tuckman, I can only say I could talk to you for another couple of hours here, and we thank you for giving us all this time.
I thank you very much. I'm deeply grateful both for your courtesy, for your interest, and I'm deeply grateful that this book will reach a wider readership because of its content and its message.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.